Committee of the Whole will come to order. The next...
Representative Landon, an act relating to Medicaid Long-Term Care Partnership Program. This bill was referred to Committee Number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, which recommended that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Bonner, Davison, Escobel, Goggles, Hallinan, Harvey, Landon, Millen, Shepperson. Signed, Representative Harvey, Vice Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Landon?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report, it do so with a recommendation that House Bill 92 do pass. Furthermore, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a recommendation that Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 do pass. And at this time, I believe the best thing would be to tell you about the bill, and then as we get after explanation of the bill, I'll go through what the Standing Committee Amendment has proposed and explain that, and we'll go from there. Long-Term Care Partnership Program is a way to incentivize people to buy long-term care health insurance, with the idea that it saves some of their assets and it saves the state Medicaid money. We have a growing population of baby boomers who are moving on into those years when they'll need home and community-based services, assisted living care, or medical home care. And Medicaid helps pay for all of these things for individuals who have a low amount of assets. And so this proposal is to encourage people to purchase, and primarily it's aimed towards middle class people to purchase long-term care insurance. And it will... At such time that they would need to be on assistance from Medicaid, the amount of money that had been paid by long-term care insurance for their care up to that time would be subtracted dollar for dollar from the Medicaid requirements of assets that you have in order to qualify. In other words, if you had bought $200,000 worth of long-term care insurance and you had required home and community-based services and then later on assisted living services and then furthermore the policy paid for nursing home services, and say the policy paid out the entire value of that $200,000, then that you were still then in a nursing home after that time, and you were using what other resources you had, once you had used those resources down to the limit that's required by Medicaid, they would not count $200,000 of your other assets. Those could either be passed on in an estate or given to a spouse or a charity or something, and they would not count those as having to be expended before you qualified for Medicaid. Let me lead you through the bill real quickly. Of course, page one tells what all it does accomplish. On page two, asset disregard, that definition refers to this fact that your assets will be disregarded dollar for dollar for the amount of money that was paid by a qualified long-term care insurance policy before you required the use of Medicaid money. The next page further defines what this policy is that we're talking about. It covers people in the state of Wyoming. This policy is actually defined in the Internal Revenue Code, and it has to meet some of the qualifications of the Federal Deficit Reduction Act. Those will be covered in the bill. On page four, this policy is sold to individuals, and here's some consumer protections in here. at various ages, you see in there are various inflation protection measures. The younger you are, the more inflation protection measures there are. Page 5, the Department of Health, along with the Insurance Commission, it outlines a number of things for them to do. I'm not going to go through that part because that part is a lot of that we took out in the Standing Committee Amendment. In fact, that is the place that I think I should bring in the Standing Committee Amendment. And this would be a useful place to have the new rule that we put in where we're going to write these Standing Committee Amendments in context. Basically, it leaves little A intact, except for on line 8. You can see that it deletes the very last part of it. So basically, the way this will read after the Standing Committee Amendment is read in, it says, there shall be established the Wyoming Long-Term Care Partnership Program to be administered by the agency, that's the Wyoming Department of Health, with the assistance of the department, that's the Insurance Commission, to provide incentives for individuals to insure against the cost of providing for their long-term care needs by creating a mechanism for individuals to qualify for coverage of the cost of their long-term care needs under Medicaid without first being required to substantially exhaust all their resources. That's how that'll read with the amendments that are outlined on the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. So if there's no questions about that Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, Mr. Chairman, I would ask that be considered.
Is there any other discussion on a Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 92? Question being called. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Standing Committee Amendment has passed. We're back on the bill. Chairman Landon.
Page 6 tells basically what it's about. The Wyoming Department of Health is going to make an application to the Federal Department of Health and Human Services to set up this long-term care partnership program where the total assets of an individual owns can be increased dollar for dollar for the amount of benefits paid out by the insurance policy. The Department of Health is going to help the Insurance Commission set these up. They want to make sure that in little Romanet 2 that the sellers understand the product. On page 7, the department can't put any special requirements on these type of insurance policies that they don't also have on all long-term care policies. The insurance companies are going to have to provide reports to the federal government. In E, these policies are reciprocal. You can take them to other participating states. There are a number of other states that have these. On page 8, this asset disregard procedure is the same whether you buy the policy in this state or another state. Then in Little Romanet I, the asset disregard is exempt from Medicare estate recovery. And then finally in Little 4, if a person moves to another state, they can still have the same policy and it's in force. Mr. Chairman, that pretty much covers the bill, and I stand for any questions.
Representative Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have any questions, but I do have some comments on this bill. This is a topic that I have personally been involved in for about 5 years, first as the chairman of the Subcommittee on Long-Term Care, and then with a national committee that supports state legislatures, we worked on how states could implement this very type of a solution to the health care costs. A lot of states that were entertaining the idea have now enacted it, but they have state income tax, and that's how they paid back their people or rewarded them for carrying these type of policies, is that they would give them direct dollar per dollar. The dollar that they paid on the long-term care policy was removed off of their state income tax liability. The states that have enacted this have found it to be very highly successful in cost containment for Medicaid, and I would urge the body to vote aye on this bill.
Representative Korberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Excuse me. I was just wondering, is the Department of Health, do they not anticipate any additional expense in order to administer this program? So that was my question. I didn't see a fiscal note attached.
Chairman Landon.
The Department of Health has predicted that there is going to be additional cost in doing this program. They actually gave to us a impact, whatever we call those, a fiscal impact, administrative impact on this, and they were requesting a position, and they were requesting about $100,000. We couldn't see that. There will be, in the initial setting up of the program, there will be some rules and regulations. But once it's ongoing, they already have people who are figuring Medicaid and determining when somebody becomes eligible for Medicaid. So we didn't see that there's going to be a need for longer term carrying on of this program. It never, when it was originally written, it wasn't written with another section requiring an appropriation, and we aren't advocating one.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make sure I understand this bill. Whatever benefits you receive under the policy, those are exempt from the means testing. And under the definition on page 3, line 5 of qualified long-term care insurance partnership policy, that's a policy that meets all of those requirements. And I assume how this works is you buy the policy when you need whatever, is it institutional care, or I suppose it could be home care too, then that policy pays out. Does it pay out in a lump sum? Does it pay out on a monthly basis? How does it pay out? That's my first question, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman Landon.
Mr. Chairman, right now there are long-term care policies, and you can buy different types. You can buy some that pay out on a monthly basis. This particular type of policy will pay out on an occurrence basis. So if a person's requiring home and community-based services, I believe it's my understanding that those will be billed directly to the policy. If after that a person lost functionality in a few more areas and would need to go to perhaps assisted living, that too would be billed directly to the policy and be paid out by the policy. If later on a person had more disabilities and needed to go into a nursing home, that too would be, those bills would be sent to the policy and paid by the policy company. Up until the limit of what the policy company, of how much insurance that you had purchased, at that point the policy would discontinue paying. So I think you can buy these in various dollar amounts. You could buy $100,000 or you could buy $200,000, perhaps more.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do they ever pay directly to the insured?
Chairman Land.
Some types of policy do. It's my understanding that this type pays the provider as bills perhaps may be funneled through the insurer, but it's my understanding that these pay for services delivered.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My only concern is that if there's a policy that pays to the insured and the insured does not use those funds for the related care, that's just a way to avoid the Medicaid reimbursement requirements under the means testing. I don't see anything in the bill other than the reference to the qualified long-term care insurance policy on page 3, line 14, and I just don't know enough about that to know whether that federal law restricts. I'm sure it restricts in some manner what you can do with the proceeds of that policy. So maybe you could provide us some additional information about the restrictions that go along with those policies, so I'd feel better that it's just not a means to, for some people to attempt to avoid the means testing.
Chairman Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I might direct you to page 6, starting on line 7, say, where an individual who's a beneficiary of this long-term partnership program policy, the total assets that individual may own and retain and still qualify for the benefits under Medicaid at the time that a person applies for the long-term benefits that you'd get from Medicaid, those are increased dollar for dollar for the benefits that have been paid out under the individual's long-term care partnership program. There's been 4 states that have had these policies for a long time, and then the government cut them off, and they just now reinstated them with the Deficit Reduction Act, and I guess that's probably been about 5 years ago now. And so my memory serves me right, there's 14 states now that have this. So far they have experience with a number of people who have used these policies. And of those who have used them, there's been 899 of these policies in which the policy owner has actually died before receiving all the benefits from the insurance policy. And there's 251 of these policies in which the policyholder outlived the benefits and then later on was able to take care of Medicaid or take that required Medicaid payments in order to pay for their care. So whenever you look at those numbers, it's helping not only the individuals who buy the policy keep more assets in their account for their family, but it's also helping lower the cost of Medicaid by having this other instrument come in and pay quite a bit of those costs before Medicaid has to pick them up. And that's why we thought this was beneficial. It seemed to be win-win for both the individuals and for the state.
Is there any other discussion on the bill?
Question.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to add at present, Medicaid is paying $84 million annually in Wyoming to provide nursing home care, and that number is only going to go up as the aging increases. Clearly, people are not preparing for this cost ahead of us, in that we also were presented figures that told us that only 2% of Wyoming residents presently carry long-term care insurance. This particular bill will incentivize people to purchase long-term care insurance. And I think, I rise and speak in favor of the bill. Thank you.
Chairman McComey.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess maybe I'm a little slow today, but I need you to explain to me one more time how this is going to incentivize people to pay this premium when they're already having trouble making ends meet. That's why they'll go under Medicaid.
Chairman Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I could see primarily individuals, a family that had maybe put together savings of and various assets of $50,000 to maybe $150,000 to $200,000, and without this insurance product, and it would cost somebody who bought it in their 50s. And I really needed to get these more exact, but maybe $100 and some a month to buy a $100,000 policy or something, let's say. The advantage would be that at the time that they needed to have services for their care, that they would not have to spend all of their own money down in order before they qualified for Medicaid, but they'd have this policy that would pay those payments. And then when the policy was done paying and Medicaid, and they said, Medicaid, will you pick up our costs now? Then Medicaid will go in and they'll say, well, you have a house and you have a car, and then actually you have $2,000. Well, you also have $100,000 over in a savings account that you have, but we aren't going to count that $100,000 because your insurance policy paid $100,000 for your care up to this point. So we're going to leave that with your family and your estate, but all the other assets that you have been paid down to where you only have $2,000 now, so we'll go ahead and start paying for your nursing home care. So the incentive is if you want to leave some money in an estate, and that could be for children, for whatever, spouse, or then this would be a method that would allow you to do this, because it's shown that you've already made the effort to take care of to fund your long-term care. And so the Medicaid isn't going to penalize that. In fact, we would like you to buy these insurance policies so that they will pay before Medicaid pays.
Representative Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one short question, and I think I know the answer, but I want to make sure. This can be retroactive, right? In other words, insurance policies, I'm looking on page 3, if they meet all of the requirements, and they've already been in place for 5 years or something like that, they still would apply to this? And if so, what is the procedure to get it qualified?
Chairman Landon.
Mr. Chairman, we don't expect these to be retroactive. We expect them to start on the day that the Department of Health gets the plan qualified by the Federal Department of Health and Human Services. But what we do expect will happen is that those who currently have long-term care insurance policies, that insurance companies will give them the opportunity to roll over that into this type of program. Because there's so many different ones out there now, some of them, as one of the earlier questions was, some of them will pay out so much a month. Some of them also pay for specific care like this. Some have no inflation protection in them, and so they're written in a whole lot of different ways. But those, it's my understanding that insurance companies will likely, and this is from the Insurance Commission, will likely offer just much like you do with a life insurance policy now. There'll be ways to roll that over into another policy.
Is there any other discussion on the bill?
Question.
Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Landon's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 110 do pass, House Bill 92 do pass, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. House Bill 92 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 221. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 221, introduced by Representative Throne, an act relating to property tax appeals. This bill was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Anderson, Edmonds, Escobel, Goggles, Madden, Miller, Peterson, Semlek, Wallace, sign Representative Anderson, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Chairman Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, to do so with recommendation that House Bill 21 do pass. There are no standing committee amendments, and I would turn the explanation of the bill over to Representative Throne.
And Chairman Anderson, would that be House Bill 221?
If that isn't what I said, I will say 221.
Representative Throne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, this afternoon I bring to you a bill that is intended to provide some procedural fairness to taxpayers challenging their tax assessments. Essentially, the DAC is stacked heavily in favor of our local tax assessors. They enjoy, and it's referenced in the bill on page 2, and the heart of the bill is on page 2. Under taxpayer remedies 3913109, our assessors and also the State Department of Revenue enjoy what's called a presumption of correctness in favor of their assessment. And this bill doesn't change that presumption of correctness. But what it does is it allows the taxpayer to introduce any credible evidence, anything that makes sense to challenge the valuation proposed by the assessor. Because I can tell you what happens now in certain cases, and I'm not familiar with every county in the state. There's an old Supreme Court case that says you can't challenge the opinion of the assessor. Well, if you can't challenge the opinion of the assessor, you can't really challenge your assessment, because your assessment is essentially the opinion of the assessor. And so the purpose of this bill is to clarify the law to allow folks to bring credible evidence into their taxpayer appeals so that they have a fair chance to point out that the assessor made a mistake. And really, and it just makes tax appeals consistent with any other appeal to the government. In any other appeal of a government decision, an administrative appeal, you can bring in opinion evidence. You can bring in credible evidence. But because of the way the Supreme Court has interpreted our tax laws over the years and then the ways those have been applied, the taxpayer really doesn't have the opportunity to bring in all credible evidence. And I want to let the body know that our local assessors association is neutral on this bill, so they're comfortable. They're comfortable defending their decisions, and there was really no opposition to the bill in committee. I think it's important in these times when folks are frustrated with their tax assessments that we at least provide them a meaningful appeal, and that's really the purpose of this bill. Not to say the taxpayer gets to walk in and say, pound the table and say, fix my bill. That's not what it's about. It's about giving taxpayers a meaningful chance to challenge their assessment. And I would stand for any questions.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know that we've ever, other than that case, that, and I don't know how old that case is, but I'm sure that anyone who is before the county board or the state board of equalization has the right to put on evidence and opinion testimony and expert testimony. And if they present evidence, then the burden shifts back to the county assessor to prove that their assessment was correct. So that's probably why the Assessors Association is simply saying, you know, fine, because that's the way we do it anyway, isn't it? I mean, has there been a problem that we're trying to address, or this is case law that is old and we might as well throw it in?
Representative Throne.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Speaker, there is a problem we're trying to address. I think that it is in some ways a statement of the existing law, but I could cite you two board opinions from Laramie County, and the case is, for the speaker's benefit, McDermott. It's a 1962 case. And the quote from that case is, a mere difference of opinion is not sufficient to overcome the presumption in favor of the assessor. And that language finds its way into county appeals. And if you'll give me a minute, I'll just quickly tell you what happened in our case. In a case in Laramie County, the county attorney basically he stood up and said, you know, the protestant has a great appraiser, county uses him, but you don't have to listen to a word he says because a mere difference of opinion is not enough to challenge the assessor. So essentially what happens is, because of this question of the role of opinion testimony, you really can't, in some circumstances, and I'm sure it varies from county to county, you can't really bring a challenge to what the assessor is doing. So there's this perception out there that the taxpayers don't have a chance.
Representative Hales.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can only speak from experience in my own county. There is in the real estate multiple listing service all the sales data from the properties that have sold. Numerous people have come to us as real estate agents asking for us to present that information when they are having cases heard, and the assessors have disallowed this information. So I think there is a problem with the taxpayer having the opportunity to present credible evidence. Thank you.
Is there any other discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Anderson's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 221 pass, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House Bill 221 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 13. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 13, introduced by the Agriculture Committee, an act relating to subdivisions. This bill was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources, and it was recommended that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Blake, Edmonds, Moniz, Semlek, Teeters, Wallace. No, Carson, Gilmore, Zwanitzer, Dan. Signed, Representative Semlek, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Semlek?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill Number 13 do pass. I move, and I further move that the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. Members of the House, this bill addresses the relationship and the responsibility that neighbors have in regard to fencing, and it specifically deals with the issue of neighbors that would be between a subdivider and the adjoining landowner to a proposed subdivision. And that's why you find the bill in Title 18 under the minimum requirements for a subdivision. There is a myriad of things currently in law that the Board of County Commissioners required of subdividers before they'll approve a preliminary plat. And some of those, as you well know, is water and sewer and, planned development for the roads and a clear title on the property and these sort of things. This bill really deals with asking the body to consider one other consideration that a Board of County Commissioner would ask of a subdivider, and it's found on page 2 and line 7 of the bill, where it says the subdivider or his agent who offers any part of the subdivision for sale or solicits any offer for the purpose thereof has discussed partition fences with all the adjoining landowners. And the partition fence that we're referring to here, I want to make that very clear, it is that perimeter fence on the subdivision. I don't think that we're particularly interested, nor is it appropriate for us to be considering what individual lot owners might have in regard to partition fences between the lots. So this deals with just the perimeter fence on the proposed subdivision. Going into the amendment on page 1, line 36, and following again back on the bill on lines 10, what are some of the options that they have here when they discuss fences with adjoining landowners? Here's a couple of things they can do. Again, page 1, line 36 of the amendment. The first thing they can do is show evidence that they have reached an agreement with each adjoining landowner regarding whether a partition fence will be erected, and if so, the requirements for construction and maintenance of the fence. What is contemplated here, that the decision in this binding agreement might simply say, we agree to do nothing. That the adjoining landowner to the subdivision says, not a problem. We don't feel it's appropriate to put a fence up here, and the agreement is that we simply won't. Or the agreement might be that the fence will be constructed of a certain kind, and as long as both parties agree to it, that fence can be of any nature. If you want to go back into what's considered to be a legal fence in Wyoming, we have guidance in the statutes as to what that would be, and the parties can stipulate to that's what it would be. In item 2 in the amendment, it goes, you find that on line 41 on page 1 of the amendment. It talks about here, if an agreement has not been reached with an adjoining landowner, the subdivider will at his sole expense erect a partition fence meeting the requirements of 1128.102C. And binding on the subdivider's successors and will be recorded, and it's that kind of that customary language we see going on into the second page. And this fence gets to be a little bit more specific as to exactly what that fence would be. And this is the type of fence that we normally consider would be for enclosing a hay crail. It specifically says it will be a certain height, it will be constructed in a certain way, and it would certainly be the hope that the subdivider and the adjoining landowner can prove evidence to the board that they have agreed on something to deal with this problem of that interface between agriculture and subdivisions. And the appropriate time to do that, I think the committee's opinion was, is to do that up front before the preliminary plat is approved. If you don't do it at that time, then you've got to deal with the issues of an interface of a lot of different lot owners, with adjoining landowner. So that is the amendment and the bill, and we'll stand for any questions.
We're on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 13. Is there any more discussion on Standing Committee Amendment Number 1? Representative Zwanitzer, the Younger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Against Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 and against the bill, to be quite honest. The bill, it has a great idea and a great intent, but we're really going about it the wrong way. And I missed the discussion in the interim. I had to leave a couple hours early. And I also sit on the Corporations Committee in this body and know exactly what we're doing with subdivisions. And I'm just really worried about where we're going with this. To talk specifically on the amendment, before I talk about the bill, if you read on page 1 of the amendment, my greatest concern, I think, is lines 36 through 45. Basically, what we're saying now, if we pass the Standing Committee Amendment, is that the subdivider and the landowner next door have to agree on this fence. And if they don't agree, basically the subdivider has to pay for the cost of fencing the entire perimeter at their sole discretion. Under Wyoming law, we have 5 different types of fences. We pick the most strict fencing requirement. And let me just read you what this is. And I want you to think about this in your mind, constructing a fence this size. Any fence enclosing any hay corral shall be 6 feet high at least, constructed of boards, poles, or wire. The posts shall not be more than 8 feet apart and set 24 inches into the ground. If the fence is constructed of barbed wire, there shall be at least 7 spans of wire across this fence, and all wire shall be kept properly stretched at all times. Any fence better than the above-described fence is also considered a lawful fence. So we're going to be enclosing a 6-foot, 7-strand barbed wire fence around an entire subdivision at basically the sole cost of the subdivider, should the landowner not agree to split the cost. Under current statute right now, the cost is split between the subdivider and the adjoining landowners. But according to this amendment, the landowner says, heck no, I don't want a fence up. We're still requiring the subdivider to put the fence up, even if the landowner doesn't want it, which doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. But then we're also making the subdivider pay for the whole thing. And I didn't run the numbers, but fencing today isn't cheap. So I would speak against the standing committee amendment, and depending if it's passage or failure, I will speak against the bill.
Is there other discussion on standing committee amendment number one? Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me explain a little bit about the evolution of the discussion in committee, because I think that will be helpful for you all to understand what we were considering and what we were up against. At first glance, when you looked at the original legislation, I think many of us had a comfort level that there is a definition of a legal fence in the livestock statutes, and there is a long-standing tradition in agriculture circles about how those fences are built and maintained between adjoining landowners, which is essentially that you each pay half every other side every other year. So if you're building a new fence, you split the cost of that. If you're maintaining that fence, 1 year you maintain it, the next year your neighbor maintains it. It works very well, and that's essentially what is codified in the Wyoming statutes with a 3-wire fence. What we heard in committee is, and I learned something. You know, my dad always told me, keep your ears open and your mouth shut, and you'll learn something once in a while, and I learned something in committee, and that is, my understanding was that Wyoming was a fence-out state. That if you wanted to keep livestock off of your property, that it was your responsibility to fence them out. And that's true for cattle and horses, but it is not true for sheep. Sheep are fence-in. So in the circumstance where you have a subdivision next to a agriculture producer who may be running sheep, then just for the fact that that subdivision has been purchased by someone and developed and is next door to you, you are now burdened with the sole cost of building and maintaining a fence. And so what we were seeking in the committee was kind of a default that says, you know, if that our first inclination was that the subdivider should come to the commissioners and indicate that they had talked to the adjoining landowners and that they had come up to an agreement, which could be that we don't want any fence at all, which is happens to be the case with a subdivision next to us. Anyway, knowing that the problem is there isn't a legal sheep-type fence in the Wyoming statutes. You only got two choices. You got a 3-wire fence or you got a hay corral fence. And we chose the hay corral fence because we did not want to unfairly burden a sheep producer. There is a lot of room here, and I think that that is probably what we do need, is a middle ground between a 3-wire fence and a 7-wire hay corral fence, but a reasonable fence that would protect an adjoining landowner in the case where they are not able to come to an agreement with a subdivider And I would encourage the body to move this forward. I think that this is a good bill, and that we can bring an amendment to the second reading that would reflect a common sense approach that wouldn't unfairly burden either the developer or an adjoining landowner.
Representative Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On and against the amendment, my concern is this body has made a policy decision that we give the power of zoning to our county governments. The counties make the determinations as to fencing. My county has an entire chapter on just fences. We don't actually allow much of fencing. The only fencing we allow are what's called wildlife-friendly fencing, which allows the elk and the moose to move over their migration routes. And for the most part, we don't actually allow much fencing to go on around subdivisions, because what our objective is to allow the wildlife to actually move. Now, I understand my situation's a little bit different. We're moving tens of thousands of elk throughout our subdivisions. They move through certain migration routes, so we work real hard to remove fences to allow that corridor to work. The bill, I'm not sure if I'm against the bill or not, because I think I can do an amendment to hopefully make this an opt-in. It sounds like some counties must have a problem with this, and so, you know, it might be good to help those counties. I have difficulty when we do a cookie-cutter approach. A few counties have a problem, and all of a sudden all the counties have to join in. That's why we left zoning up to each particular county, because I'm sure, you know, when I talk about wildlife-friendly fences, people roll their eyes. But, you know, that's unique to my county, and we should be allowed to do what's unique to my community and not be forced into a cookie cutter. The amendment goes way beyond what I think the bill does. The amendment's talking about you shall, that you've reached this agreement, and that it almost appears as if the adjoining landowner trumps the county commissioner. So if the commissioner said, no, you don't need to put up a fence there, when they come in to do the zoning, the adjoining landowner is always going to have the control, which I'm not sure if that's really what we wanted to be doing. I'm against the amendment.
Representative Korberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I just have a question about the amendment and as it relates to the bill, because, of course, if I understand the subdivision permitting requirements, the County Commission Board may by rule exempt any subdivision from any of the following requirements. So that would include this part of the statute that we're talking about enacting right now about fences. Yet the amendment, particularly Roman numeral 2, it makes it sound like they can't exempt it, that the fence is going to go up here regardless, because if an agreement hasn't been reached, the subdivider will at his sole expense erect a partition fence. So I think, I don't know, to me it sounds like there's conflict between what we're allowing the commissioner's authority to exempt, and then in the amendment it makes it sound like, well, they can't exempt fencing. So I would just like some clarification on that point. Thank you.
Representative Bagby.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Robert Frost once said, good fences make good neighbors. Standing in favor of the amendment.
Chairman said, Representative Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I realize that this may be distasteful to a lot of the members in the House, especially Section 2, but you have to realize the situation that we were in. If you consider sheep producers and the fact that it's their responsibility and obligation to ensure that their sheep are fenced in, we have a real problem here, because if a subdivision comes in and doesn't build a fence that's adequate and there's not an agreement that's made, then that sheep producer is essentially at the will of the authorities at that point, because he's in violation of the fencing law. So we need some sort of a definition of a sheep-type fence. I think that would make a lot of this go away. But as far as the cattle producers go, you can turn your cattle out, and if they don't want to build a fence, I mean, there's a real burden on the point of the subdivider to try and come to the table and negotiate with the landowner in most situations when you're dealing with cattle and horses. But we do have a problem with the sheep, and I would encourage people to adopt this amendment, and we'll work on a second reading amendment that'll hopefully be more palatable to the body.
Representative Escobel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I always get a little suspect in these type of bills where you get a standing committee amendment that's actually longer than the bill, and it causes you to read a little further into it, and then you start hearing some debate about, well, we'll fix it on second amendment. It's just a bad bill. It's a bad amendment, and I urge the body to resist this and have the committee go back to the drawing board and bring the body back something a little bit more palatable on and against the amendment and against the bill.
Representative Patton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just raised the question that on page 1 of the amendment, line 36, down through 39, it reads to me as though you have to secure the agreement of each adjoining landowner, of which the figure is plural. And as it's drafted, it would occur to me that one obstinate landowner, even though small in size, might have the veto over the operation. And so should this amendment succeed and the bill progress on, I would certainly suggest you address that specific problem before we consider further. Thank you.
Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to respond to the last question and to point out that the agreement would only be in the reach of that particular adjoining owner. Take the hypothetical question where you have a square section subdivision bordered on four sides by four different landowners, and landowner A, B, and C come to an agreement. They either decide that yes, they do want a fence, or no, they don't care, and landowner D is a sheep rancher, and where a fence does not exist now, that sole obligation would be on him to build that fence. So that fence would only be on that one side. It wouldn't have to extend around to the other sides. So it would only be where that meets with that particular landowner.
Representative Stubson.
Mr. Chairman, I'm missing one piece of this, and in the part I understand is if a subdivision moves next door, you as a sheep producer would want that subdivision to build a fence to keep your sheep in. But if we are a fence-in state with respect to sheep, don't you have that obligation to construct that fence to keep your sheep in the first place before any subdivision even shows up there? And so if that obligation is there, I guess I'm confused as to why we need this provision. So I hope I didn't confuse you too badly.
Representative Gilmore.
Yes, Mr. Speaker. Number one, what happened to the fence that was already there? In most cases, I'm at least in Natrona County, the rancher is the guy who sold the land to the developer in the first place. The developer didn't just come out in the middle of the country and grab some acreage. And I think without this bill at all, they should be able to negotiate a fence. The guy with the sheep operation probably would deserve a fence if someone went into the middle of a school section, somehow bought it from the state. But under normal circumstances, I'm thinking, I agree with my friend from Albany County that there's the amendment's longer than the bill. So I'm against both.
Representative Zwanitzer.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Just some quick points to leave you with. What if the adjoining entity is a government, a city government, a state government, the federal government? It's a national park, it's a national forest. The counties didn't come to us in this bill. My county commissioners are against this. The ag groups came to us, and we're putting more regulations on the county commissioners to have to oversee fencing now. And I do agree with many of the good speakers that this is a timely issue, and we do have problems we need to address, but this bill is certainly not the way to do this. Right now, these are minimum regulations for county commissioners to think about when considering whether or not a subdivision should go in. I just want you to think, we had the example of four landowners. What if you have 20 adjoining landowners? What if you have a 70,000-acre lot like what we have in Natrona County that got sold? Are you going to have to fence that entire thing with a 6-foot fence and 7 tight wires at all times across it? And that's basically the minimum. Otherwise, they're boards, poles, etc. And if you're going to be buying a house, are you going to buy a piece of property knowing you have to maintain a 6-foot fence around your property at all times? Would you want a 6-foot fence around your property at all times? How many of us want a view shed where you have to look over a 6-foot fence? I think there are serious complications with this amendment. I'd ask you to defeat it. We can probably come back with something on second reading that might make this bill more palatable if we don't kill it today. Thank you.
Chairman McComey.
Well, thank you, Mr. Speaker. I mean, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, now there, probably the best sheep-type fence there is a woven wire fence, a 32-inch woven wire fence. So I don't know if we don't have that in the state statutes or what. I don't know why we chose a 7-wire barbed wire fence. But, you know, if you leave this to the county commissioners to decide the types of fences and various other things, it could be, as the good gentleman from Teton County said, can vary depending upon where you live and some of the circumstances. But if we put in the bill, it's going to be a 7 barbed wire fence. I'm not real sure that's a smart thing to do. I guess I'm against the amendment.
Representative Roscoe.
On and against the amendment. Don't feel that the state should be deciding this fence issue. The county commissioner should. Thank you.
We're on standing committee amendment number 1 to House Bill 13. Question having been called, all those in favor of the standing committee amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Standing committee amendment number 1 to House Bill 13 has failed. We're back on the bill. Question. Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just note, couple things. We've killed the standing committee amendment, and what it had said was, there on line 2, that it was going to specify requirements to erect and maintain partition fences, make conforming amendments. I don't think this bill was ready for prime time. Quite frankly, it looks like if the committee wants to do something, it ought to come back next year, take a look at it. The other thing, requiring the county commissioners to do these things, it should be opt-in. County commissioners have enough to do. We've talked to them about subdivisions. We've talked to them about cluster developments. I just don't think that this is where we want to go with these partition fences. And quite frankly, I've received enough emails in my computer that it's getting clogged up with people that are saying, this is the heavy hand of government one more time.
Chairman Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm willing to go along with this, with the proposals in this bill until I hear and give the those who are for it an opportunity to and who have brought it an opportunity to repair some of the flaws they've heard about today. But I do have one question, and that is, do the county commissioners have the power now within their local governance to regulate this within the county, or do they need this power to have a minimum requirements for fencing or in order to have this power to do this in subdivisions?
Chairman Simlick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess it'd be my impression, unless you have zoning, that they probably do not have the authority to do this. The concerns about it, perhaps it should be an opt-in or opt-out. You know, that's that's certainly something that, you know, that could be done. We're just, again, we're just trying to deal with that interface of the changing face of Wyoming with subdivisions. This is, certainly wasn't intended to be an anti-development bill. We just believe that if a subdivider can sit down with adjoining landowners and make some decisions up front as to what the fencing criteria might look like and provide that information to the county commissioners. The county commissioners, it's at their discretion. All this simply says is evidence satisfactory to the board that the subdivider has discussed partition fences with adjoining landowners, and that's really without the amendment. That's really what the bill does, and I'll just leave it up to the will of the House to decide what you want to do with this. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lubnow.
Mr. Chairman, I'm looking at, of course, the boundary fence statute 1128-106 that says that if you need to build a boundary fence, you can build it and bill your neighbor for half of it. And then it specifies in 1128-102 what the boundary fence statute says and gives specifications for what a lawful fence is in the state of Wyoming. And I just am curious and would like to ask the bringer, well, I guess there is no such thing as a bringer or brunger, the sponsor, what this bill adds that we don't already have in statute.
Representative Korberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I, too, am concerned about this bill because it just, you know, there's ample opportunity for adjoining landowners to participate in the subdivision process. They have to be notified when the subdivision process takes care. There's hearings before the Land Use Planning Board, and I believe also in front of the county commissioners. So it seems to me that there's a lot of opportunity for adjoining landowners to participate in this entire process, and I'm kind of concerned that we're trying to legislate the county commissioners into actual zoning without really saying it. So I have real concerns about this bill.
Representative Davison.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also can't support this bill. The Wyoming County Commissioners Association are opposing this bill because it requires arrangements for the partition fences prior to the approval of a subdivision. So I think we better think very carefully about it. Thank you.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That standing committee amendment that failed shows you 1128-106. And that's current law that says the owner of any lawful fence, which is or becomes a partition fence, is responsible for one half the cost of constructing the fence. And if you don't pay it, you can be sued, and that's the law. So in an instance of a subdivision where there are existing fences, and those will become partition fences, and those lots are then sold to people who are buying the subdivision lots, and the guy who was there first who had the fence sues the subdivision lot owner because the fence needs to be repaired, and the subdivision lot owner says, what? I mean, we see this all the time in subdivisions in Wyoming where people move in and have no idea what the laws are in Wyoming about fencing out, fencing in, water, whatever it is. The bill to me on page 2, lines 5 through 10, that sounds great. They've discussed the partition fence with all adjoining landowners. And then once you get into this binding arrangements, this to me is more of a notice issue to the lot buyer about what they're buying. And it depends on the size of the lots, whether there are existing fences or not. So I don't know if we have a actually, I don't know what the genesis of the bill is. I didn't think it was because of sheep. I thought it was because of partition fences. And if it's because of partition fences, the question then is, how do you give notice to a subdivision lot owner, and do you put the onus on the subdivider to figure those things out before they subdivide it? And if so, is it then placed into the plat so the lot owner can't say, I didn't know, because it's on the plat or in the covenants that they buy that you're responsible for the partition fence that adjoins your lot? So maybe somebody could shed some light on those issues. It's a joint committee bill, and if the idea was to just address the sheep issue, that's different. But if it's to really give notice to people, we could probably do something reasonable with the bill. Thank you.
Chairman Semlick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The discussion of the bill really came up as a result of landowners out next to subdivisions who are trying to get some understanding of what it takes to be a good neighbor across a fence. And the sheep issue did come up in the committee discussion as we tried to find an appropriate fence that in statute that would actually deal with a construction that would really keep sheep in. So that it kind of migrated to that issue, and we kind of end up in a default mode of saying, well, if they can't agree on anything, well, then this is the type of fence that's going to go to. But really, I think if it's a part of the subdivision plan and there is notice given to the subdivider and to the people who purchase lots in there, that they have some understanding, again, of what it takes, to be a good neighbor next to our agricultural people. And that was really the genesis of the bill. And as we worked it through committee, we found some difficulty in trying to figure out in that section 2 of the amendment. I don't think any of us on the committee would agree that we're not real satisfied with that language, but that was the only thing we had available to us at that time. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I think that the House has debated it enough. Thank you.
Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Semlick's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 13 do pass, signify by saying aye. Those opposed, no.
No.
Pursuant to House Rule 10-5B, the bill having failed a voice vote, a standing division vote is required. All those in favor, please stand. Those opposed, stand. Having failed the standing division vote, a roll call vote is required. The chief clerk will call the roll.
Anderson. Bagby. Barbudo. Berger. Blake. Bonner. Brechtel. Brown.
No.
Buchanan.
No.
Bird.
No.
Kennedy.
No.
Carson.
No.
Childers.
No.
Cohey.
No.
Connolly.
No.
Kraft.
No.
Davison.
No.
Dirks.
No.
Edmonds.
No.
Esquivel.
No.
Gilmore.
No.
Gingery.
No.
Goggles.
No.
Hales.
No.
Hallinan.
No.
Hammonds. Harshman.
No.
Harvey.
No.
Illaway.
No.
Yagi.
No.
Jorgensen. Jorgensen. Landon.
No.
Lockhart.
No.
Lubno.
No.
Madden.
No.
McKim.
No.
McComey.
No.
Mercer.
No.
Meyer.
No.
Miller. Miller. Millen.
No.
Moniz.
No.
Patton.
No.
Peasley.
No.
Pedersen.
No.
Peterson.
No.
Philp.
Aye.
Korberg.
No.
Roscoe.
No.
Semlick.
Aye.
Shepperson.
No.
Stewart. Stewart. Stubson.
No.
Teeters.
No.
Thompson.
No.
Throne.
No.
Wallace.
Aye.
Swanitzer Dan.
No.
Swanitzer Dave.
No.
Mr. Speaker.
No.
Jorgensen.
Excused.
Jorgensen excused. Miller.
Excused.
Miller excused. Stewart.
Excused.
Stewart excused. I'm about to close the vote. Are there any changes? The vote is closed. 7 ayes, 50 noes, 3 excused.
Pursuant to House Rule 10-5B, House Bill 13, having failed a roll call vote, is indefinitely postponed. Representative Hallinan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sheepishly, I ask for privilege of the floor.
Representative Bagby, did Robert Frost have anything to say about that? Please proceed, Representative Helen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have the honor of having in our galleries all around us 140, or at least a big portion of 140 student nurses here in the state of Wyoming. We also have members of the leadership and membership of the Wyoming Nursing Association, and among those is the president of that association, and she's from Gillette, and that's Sue Howard, and she's up in this part of the gallery. So everybody, give them a hand.
Welcome to the House. We're happy to have you all here. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Folks, we're going to move House Bills 76, 47, 83, 190, and 35 to come after House Bill 149, Notaries. House Bills 76, 47, 83, 190, and 35, take those, and we'll consider those right after House Bill 149, Notaries.
The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 16. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 16, introduced by the Agriculture Committee, an act relating to food safety regarding the cottage food industry. This bill was referred to Committee No. 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources, which recommended that it do pass with the amendments. Ayes, Blake, Carson, Edmonds, Gilmore, Moniz, Semlick, Teeters, Wallace, Swanitzer, Dan. Signed, Representative Semlick, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Semlick?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill number 16 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. And, Mr. Chairman, I turn the management of the bill over to the good representative from House District 52, who has just recently turned from the land of fruits and nuts. Thank you.
Representative Wallace, before we proceed, do you want to speak on the Standing Committee Amendment, or would you prefer that we vote on it right now?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With your permission, what I would like to do is incorporate the Standing Committee Amendment into my discussion of the bill, and I think it'll make a lot of sense to the body in that matter.
Please proceed, Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This committee bill was brought forth by the Department of Agriculture in the wake of the Wyoming Homemade Products Bill that passed the House unanimously. Every time it came up for a vote in the last session but was defeated in the Senate committee on the grounds that it was far too dangerous to inflict uninspected and uncertified homemade cookies, cakes, and breads on an unsuspecting public. And the bill that the department presented to the committee, they recognized that with the growth, the tremendous growth in farmers' markets and those kind of relationship driven direct consumer sales around the state, and the interest in local foods and local food systems, that there was a need for some flexibility, because as the statutes are currently written, back in, I believe, 2000, they essentially deleted all of the dairy and meat and food-related statutes and left the authority for the department to promulgate rules and regulations under the food rule, which says that you cannot make any food except raw, unprocessed, unsliced fruits and vegetables unless it's made in a certified kitchen, which actually excludes any home kitchens. So there is a need for some flexibility there, especially in terms of what we would term non-hazardous foods. So as you look through the bill, the first place where we come to a bit of the Standing Committee amendment is in the definitions. The very first definition on page 2, starting with line 1, is the definition of what is a cottage food establishment. Means a licensed establishment in a person's private home utilizing home-style equipment in producing a non-potentially hazardous food for sale or distribution to the Standing Committee changed that to final consumer, okay, instead of the general public. And then the second definition is the definition of function. And that requires a little bit of explanation about why do we need to have a definition of function. And if you go to the existing statute, 357-124, what you have is the any person processing, distributing, storing, preparing any food for wholesale or retail use shall obtain a license. And then it provides for some exemptions. Down below, and in subsection E, it says that the provisions of this subsection shall not apply to food operators or kitchens in private homes that prepare food that is not potentially hazardous and prepared for sale and use at functions, including those operated by not-for-profit, charitable, or religious organizations. So, using a function was not defined in the law, and using a very, very narrow interpretation of that, let me read that bit to you again. At functions, including those operated by not-for-profit, charitable, or religious organizations, the department interpreted that to mean that the only people who could prepare food in their private kitchens were people who were doing so for a charitable or not-for-profit organization. So, in this case, we have people who have been baking cookies in their homes for 5 or 6 years and selling them at the local farmers market, who are being shut down by the food inspectors because they are making a profit. Now, let me make this perfectly clear. Under this interpretation, if I made a batch of chocolate chip cookies and I took half of them down to the Boy Scout bake sale, that's perfectly legal. If I take the other half of them down to the local farmer's market and sell them, that is illegal. Now, my contention is that the job of the department is to protect the safety of the public. And I nowhere can tell, can see what the difference is, how the cookies I sold to the Boy Scouts was safer and the public was more protected than the cookies I sold at the farmer's market. So, the reason we need a definition of function is to clearly define in the statute that a function means any gathering or occasion. And the standing committee amendment changes that to function means any official ceremony or organized social occasion. And we'll come back to that later in a committee of the whole amendment. And then finally, the third definition under the bill is for not potentially hazardous food. As the bill came to the committee, it did not include this definition. And in fact, in the bill that originally came to the committee in the interim, the definition that you see above for the cottage food establishment was the only place that was ever mentioned in the statute. It's mentioned nowhere else. And we felt that it was important to have a specific definition of what is or is not a potentially hazardous food. And this definition comes from other states. Virginia passed the Virginia Kitchen Bill. This past go-around that is very similar to what you see before you today. And very similar to the homemade products bill from last year. And also, I think the exact wording came out of the Minnesota Pickle Bill, which essentially allows people to make these sort of bake sale safe foods and sell them at a farmer's market without certification or inspection. Then, finally, moving on down through the bill, we have here 357-124 pulled in, which talks about the licensing that's required. And on page 3, there is some language that is deleted that refers to the fees that were in the original statutes. And then finally on page 4, we come around to where we have inserted new language that the director shall establish license categories and fees by rule, and no fee shall exceed, originally said $200, the standing committee amendment changes that to $100 to be consistent with other parts of the food rule. And then we come to the 357-124 exemption paragraph, and this was the trouble spot this summer where farmers markets vendors were shut down, and that was based on this interpretation, the very narrow interpretation that we've already discussed. And so the standing committee or the interim committee included an amendment that says that food may be prepared in private homes that prepare food that is not potentially hazardous and prepared for sale or use at farmers markets, roadside stands, private homes, and at functions including, but not limited to, those operated by not-for-profit, charitable, or religious organizations. And then because we have put a much more clear definition of what exactly a non-hazardous food is in the definitions, it was no longer necessary to include that, and so we deleted that from the end of the bill. So, Mr. Chairman, that's essentially the bill, and I would answer any questions.
Is there any more discussion on Standing Amendment 1 to House Bill 16? Question being called. All those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 16 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 16 has passed. Representative Wallace.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 and talk about that.
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, if you kind of ignore the things that are just conforming, where you get into it is on line 6 of the amendment, which is on page 2 of the bill, and it refers to the cottage food establishment definition. And as it was already pointed out, this is the only place in this legislation where cottage food establishment appears, and it's only in a definition. And we are bringing this amendment to delete that from the bill. Without it, we have clarified what I believe the clear intent of the exemption to include the ability of people to prepare these non-hazardous foods. And I think that's the key to keep in your mind. One of the things that we did over the interim is we were struggling with this problem that the farmers market vendors were having around the state. Is I asked LSO to prepare a report on all of the foodborne diseases outbreaks that Wyoming had experienced in recent years, and I got that, and it is goes into quite a lot of detail about the various outbreaks, and the reason that's important is that in that report, I think 12, 14 pages long. These foods that we're talking about that would be included in the definition of a non-hazardous food do not appear in that report at all. So these foods are not making anybody sick. And with this definition intact, that gives this department the ability to promulgate rules and regulations for which they intend to require inspections. They may include things like you would have to have your recipes approved by the department before you could make them. And I don't know how many of you attend farmers markets, but I do. I love them. And I love to buy these products. And the typical farmers market vendor is a housewife with some little kids at home who decides to make a half a dozen pies and take them down and just kind of see how she does. And if you start putting a lot of obstacles and expensive regulations onto that, what's going to happen is that those folks won't come and we won't have the ability to buy those products. So that is the reason for deleting that definition. We still have a lot of clarification about the exemption left in the bill. And the other thing that this Committee of the Whole amendment does is delete the Standing Committee amendments to page 2, lines 7 and 8, so it would revert to function means any gathering or occasion. And I would stand for questions.
We're on Committee of the Whole, Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 16. Representative Swanser.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to divide the amendment. Division 1 would be lines 1 through 7. How about 1 through 8? My vision's falling on me. 1 through 8 would be Division 1, and then lines 9 through 12 basically would be Division 2. I have no real concern with Division 1. It's probably appropriate we take out a definition that has no teeth at this time, and if we can approve that, then I'll talk in Division 2.
Chair rules that division's in order, and so we are now on Division 1 of Committee of the Whole, Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 16. Question being called. All in favor of Division 1, that's lines 1 through 8, of Committee of the Whole, Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 16, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Division 1 has passed. We're now on Division 2 of Committee of the Whole, Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 16, Representative Zwanzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question we have before us is somewhat of a policy question, but otherwise it's a definition question. The question basically being, what do we want function to be defined as? Would you rather it be, well, currently since we just passed the Standing Committee Amendment, it's now defined as an official ceremony or organized social occasion. If we pass this, it's going to be redefined now, going back to the bill, as any gathering or occasion. There are many people in the food safety industry who felt that was way too broad of a definition. Any two people anywhere is a gathering. If you look on page 4 of the bill, what else we're doing in this legislation, we are basically allowing this provision to not apply if they're sold at farmers markets, roadside stands, private homes, and at functions. So we're already taking out farmers markets, roadside stands, and private homes. Function, at least with the tighter definition, does offer some boundaries. If we put function back to any gathering, there's no even real need for language on lines 11 and 12 because they're already covered under function. So I would ask that we defeat this part of the amendment, keep the definition of function as official ceremony or organized social occasion. We're already covering farmers markets, roadside stands, and private homes. Without broadening function to basically be whatever. Thank you.
Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, let's run through that as we've just talked about. We've got function, which means any official ceremony or organized social occasion, as well as, okay, farmers' functions, farmers' markets, roadside stands, private homes, and at functions, and at official ceremonies or organized social occasions, including but not limited to those operated by not-for-profit, charitable, or religious organizations. So in my community, I have a number of neighbors who make arts and crafts. And they gather together once a fall at the community hall, and they have a bazaar where they sell these things for the holiday season. So that is not an official ceremony, nor is it really an organized social occasion, nor is it sponsored by a nonprofit. So in this case, and we've already experienced a department that is very interested in narrowly defining these terms in order to include as many, regulate as many of these kinds of gatherings as they can. I guess I would just leave it to the body, but I much prefer that function means exactly what the dictionary says, and that is any gathering or occasion.
Representative Zwanzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually looked through the statutes for function to define 8 times at least in different capacities. The word function is multivariable. As was stated earlier, this was a bill that came before as an interim committee study based on a bill from last year, where I think all sides made a good faith effort to try to make this work, and I hope we still are. But the entities that are somewhat regulatory, both at the state level and at certain city, county regulatory people, because in some municipalities this is regulated by the county or the city, are slightly uneasy with where this bill has been taken. And I think we can all be very upfront about that public health and safety is an issue of this body, that those regulatory agencies do have a statutory authority to provide for the public health and welfare of our citizenry. I don't think anybody in any of those agencies wants an overburdensome government, but they do want some boundaries in the law and some specificity on what is allowable and what isn't. I would argue that they are trying to put boxes and boundaries on what can be defined and what can't, but they are worried about this new idea that anybody can make within boundaries, anybody can make bread, cookies, cakes, provide them to the public at any function. It's tough to regulate, and it's tough to meet their statutory mission of public health and safety in doing so. And I think most of us in this body take for granted that every time we eat a product at a store or at a farmer's market, it's going to be safe and healthy. And I hope, with all hope that there is, that all of these products that start going on the market and farmer's markets and roadside stands are healthy and they are safe. But we do have foodborne outbreaks. And I'll tell you, as a person who was at a certain hotel in Natrona County when it had a foodborne outbreak, actually it was a consumer health conference, ironically enough, that company didn't last in business for another year. We talked a lot about health and safety of our children this morning. I don't know how many of you have experienced or seen a child who's 8 or 9 who has foodborne illness, who's sick for weeks, but it can be a pretty scary thing as well. So what we're asking for is to define function with some boundaries so it doesn't, you know, include just anything under the sun, as a gathering does, but put some specificity in our law to allow the department to do its job, regulate where it needs to regulate. I don't think they're going to take advantage, or I don't think they're going to go on a witch hunt with this stuff. They just want some boundaries to be able to do their job. Thank you.
Chairman McComey.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess my only concern with the language in the second division is we keep sending a bill like this to the Senate, and it keeps not even getting out of committee. And maybe that's one of the reasons. Maybe we need to be a little more careful and define things a little bit more. They don't seem to want to change it and send it back for a conference committee. So I'm not too sure of the objection to the function. What do we call that? Where they explain what function is, describe the function. Anyway, I'm not uncomfortable with the way it is in the amendment, the original amendment. Thank you.
Is there any more discussion on Division 2 to Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 16? Representative Hales.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There exists in the Food Safety Act provisions for religious and charitable organizations to continue their present work. However, this bill would greatly expand that. And non-potentially hazardous food is widely misunderstood and severely restricted scientific and legal term, and it should not be construed as harmless. There were 1,012 cases of salmonella, E. coli, and other various diseases reported to the Wyoming Health Department from 2003 to 2008, and 70% were not part of any commercial establishment, but were caused by day-to-day mishandling in home settings. The Governor's Food Safety Council, which was established by statute specifically to review and advise on reported changes to food safety, has recommended that we should not be weakened.
Point of order, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman Landon.
Mr. Chairman, I feel bad to interrupt the argument because it's been well thought out, but the issue at hand is the definition in the amendment. And that I think is what needs to be addressed at this point. And then as soon as that's dealt with, then we'll go back to the bill as a whole and have a more full discussion of that.
Representative Hales, would you allow me to hold you in suspense for a moment until we get the Committee of the Whole amendment settled?
I certainly would.
Is there any more discussion on Division 2 to Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 16? Question being called. All those in favor of Division 2 of Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 16 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Division 2 has failed. We're back on the bill. Stay with me a minute, Representative Hales. Representative Zwanitzer. Division having been called, all those in favor of Division 2 of Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 12 stand. And those opposed stand. Division 2 to Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 16 has failed. We're back on the bill. Stay with me, Representative Hales. Representative Zwanitzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2 to House Bill 16 and ask for its favorable passage. Basically, it just adds the word back into the statute, page 2, line 22, under distributing. I'm not sure this is going to be controversial or not, but somewhere in trying to make this policy work, I think we got confused in the interim, and we took out distributing out of current state law. The regulatory agencies, both city, county, and state, would all like to see this provision put back in. Basically, when states such as bottled water that's bottled in other states comes into Wyoming, the regulatory agencies would still like to be oversee distributing. So it wasn't processed here, may or may not be stored or prepared here, but there are a lot of products that come into our state that the department oversees and inspects based on the distributing part of the statute that's in current law that I think we mistakenly took out. You'll see it's also there on line 7 on page 3. We didn't take it out there, and I think we just messed up in committee, but I'll stand for any questions.
Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have no objection to the amendment as presented, which removes or reinserts distributing on page 2, line 22, where we're talking about everyone who is required to obtain a license. However, it is very important not to take it out of page 3, line 7, because that sentence is about the agricultural producer shall be exempt from the licensure requirement in this section for processing, distributing, storing, or sale of any raw agricultural commodity he produces. That needs to stay intact. Thank you.
Question being called. All those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2 to House Bill 16 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 2 to House Bill 16 has passed. We're back on the bill. Representative Hales.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Please keep me in order here. I have received calls from the Natrona County Health Department, and the information that they have given me causes me concern about the bill itself. The information I started to give you was that there were 1,012 cases of Salmonella, E. coli, and other diseases reported to the Wyoming Health Department from 2003 to 2008, and 70% of those were caused by day-to-day mishandling in home settings. The Governor's Food Safety Council, which was established by statute specifically to review and advise on proposed changes to food safety controls, has recommended that we should not weaken this act by this particular bill. Thank you.
Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The things I would like to point out to you that are in this bill is a clear definition of what is and is not a hazardous food. And that definition, which includes food that do not require either a time or a temperature control for safety to limit pathogenic microorganism growth or toxin formation. This means stuff that it's absolutely safe to leave out on your counter for days. This is bake sale safe items. The illnesses that were reported in the LSO report received from the Department of Health, almost without exception, the major outbreaks all happened in large commercial kitchens and did not involve food that was prepared in your home kitchen. So one of the differences between the efforts we saw last year and this year is the inclusion of this scientific and very clear definition, so everyone knows exactly what they are allowed to make in their home kitchen and sell at specific events. And the definition isn't just left up to whim. So some of the occurrences, the previous speaker who talked about how ill he became, I would point out that that illness did not derive from one of these products. We're talking cakes, cookies, baked goods, jams and jellies are about the only things that would actually qualify as having a natural pH or a final pH of 4.6 or less. That's real easy and clear to define. Now, what's the alternative? The alternative is that we say that before you can make and prepare any of these foods, that you have to allow the Department of Health, that the food consumer, the safety department of the Department of Agriculture, in to inspect your house. You have to follow a whole raft of regulations that, because we're talking about non-hazardous food, I and many like myself believe is absolutely unnecessary and is bureaucratic overkill. Enough said. I call for the question.
Representative Korberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I was just wondering if the committee had any discussion. It would seem to me that one of the easier solutions to this entire discussion would be some type of disclosure that would have to be put on these products, kind of buyer beware that this product, this pie, these cookies, these brownies are not subject to the inspection and control of the Wyoming Department of Agriculture. I mean, was there any discussion in the committee about that type of a solution? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In my county in the last month, we have had over 88 people laid off from their jobs. It seems to me that this, in this tough economic times, that I should be able to go to a person in my community and buy homemade bread from them without the interference of the government. Can't I help families who need to subsidize their income through this type of activity? And y'all just stay out of it. Can't I help them? Can't they help me?
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the floor, if you look on page 2, line 10, the heart of this bill is vested in lines 10 through 14. It has various classifications, restrictions on the type of foods that can be sold at these various events. there's always an issue with these kind of bills, and that's called enforcement. And I don't know how many members of this floor have ever had stomach or intestinal problems off of eating bad food. But here's what you find on these circumstances. You can have all the rules and regulations you want in the statute books, but if all of a sudden people are bringing the very merchandise to these local sales, it spreads, and they're not going to say, well, I better check the statute books here to see if I can bring that food there. They'll bring whatever food they want to those things, and the next thing you know, you're going right in the face of this legislation that has a good intent. There's no question about that, but the practicalities is, I don't think you can control, I don't think you can regulate that, and then you open the door wide up. So enforcement's a big issue. Knowledge is the second issue on this program here. And third, I hope none of you ever get food poisoning.
Chairman Cohey.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I agree wholeheartedly with the last two speakers. There is a third component to that, and that's what we Americans used to pride in, personal responsibility. If you go to a bake sale and you have some fear of getting some nasty disease, don't buy the darn thing. Just don't buy it. Don't take it home and feed it to your kids. Otherwise, if you live in the world where most of us do, that there are some dangerous days and maybe you're going to eat a pie baked by somebody and maybe something's in it and you're going to get sick, so be it. But that's the level of personal responsibility, and you don't go after the person that made the pie. You're the one that made the choice. On and in favor of the bill.
Representative Zwanitzer.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I haven't even decided if I like this bill or not, and it's been before me for 2 years now. But just want to bring up a couple other things that I felt were lost in the argument. There's two separate issues here. One is food safety. The other is what we deal with a lot in this body, competition. And basically the question is, can you make something at home without supervision and sell it at a farmer's market or at a roadside stand without being subject to the same inspection and rules that other people have to pay if they didn't grow it, if they weren't the agricultural producer? I mean, so that's the economic question. The competition question is, we're going to allow this whole new enterprise that you can make stuff at home and sell them, like the good representative from Lovell said, and I agree with her that that should probably be allowed. I don't know when the opposite end of the argument comes in on food safety. If you poison your neighbor, if you made it wrong, if you kill somebody, I mean, you're not a corporation or a licensed entity. You can be sued, I guess, for all you're worth, and that's a risk that you can be willing to take. And not to, just to make sure we put boundaries on this, currently in statute, you can already prepare something for sale or use at a nonprofit or a charitable event, at a church service. You can already do that under current law. We're basically adding in farmers markets, roadside stands. Roadside stand isn't defined anywhere in Wyoming law, so I'm a little uneasy about that. Private homes. But we're really, what this bill allows is for you to make something at home and sell it freely without inspection, without consumer safety guidelines. And yes, I guess that's in your own home. But if you're out in the industry and you're competing against people to sell your homemade bread or pie or cookies or cake or whatever it is, you're on an open market against everybody else that's being regulated, and you're not. And I guess that's a public policy question. You probably aren't going to be able to produce as much as somebody else, but what if you can? What if you have a couple of kitchens, you start making this into a business? There's no clear delineation of where the line is. So taxes. And yeah, I guess I'm not sure if you're charged for taxes either. That would be my hopefully pros and cons and what to think about as this bill goes forward. It does have, I think, some issues ahead of it that we're going to continue to discuss. Thanks.
Chairman Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I could use the temporary rank I have here and say, as chairman of the Labor, Health, and Social Services Committee, you know, I happen to have the good opportunity to go up to the country to the north of us a few years ago, and we were traveling along a back road and saw a little sign that said homemade bread and drove over to it. And it was kind of like buying worms somewhere, you know, where the kid puts out the cup out there and you put your money in there and pick up your little box of worms. But this was bread, and it was they'd made this nice little stand and it was in shade, and it had plexiglass all around it and shelves, and the bread was several different kinds of seeds in it, of this and that. But what a treat to buy a piece of bread and put two American dollars at that time, and not Canadian dollars. American dollars were worth a lot more at that time, in their little cup, and drive on down the road with our homemade bread. And I just think that, you know, that sort of thing is what adds quality of life to a community. And I think that this is something that we can enrich Wyoming with. I don't think we have to worry about this too much. I'm not concerned about an unfair advantage. I think that this is how people get started. They have something, they create a good product, they go out, it's successful, they get to test market it in their farmer's market. If it's successful, you bet they'll be setting up a commercial kitchen and they'll really be rolling some product out. So I think the risk, I think that's what we need to weigh here, the risk for the benefit. And I think that the definitions for that non-potentially hazardous food is a pretty high standard. We do a lot of home canning and everything, and it looks to me like that would pretty much guarantee the food's going to be safe. So on and for the bill.
Representative Wallace.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to briefly answer a couple of the questions that came up. In regards to whether we should include some sort of a disclaimer, a placard on your table or something along the sides of that that says, this food has been prepared in a home kitchen and has not been governmentally inspected. I have no problems with that. In fact, the Virginia Kitchen Bill and the Minnesota Pickle Bill both included those, and if someone wanted to bring that forward, I certainly wouldn't object. I don't think it's necessary, but so be it. I think that the other concerns have been dealt with quite articulately by others, and unless there's more questions, I would just call for the question.
Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Semlich's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, do so with the recommendation that House Bill number 16, as amended, do pass, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
House Bill 16 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 149. The reading clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 149, introduced by Representative Gingrey, an act relating to notaries. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which respectfully reported back to that it was recommended with amendments. Ayes, Bagby, Barbuto, Kennedy, Gingrey, Mercer, Patton, Korberg, Throne, No, Peasley. Signed, Representative Gingrey, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Gingrey?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number 149 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. And I'll explain the Standing Committee Amendment first. There are two different dates in this bill. One is the date dealing with when does the new application process start for notaries, and then there's a different date at the end of the bill dealing with when does this bill actually go into effect. And the Secretary of State's office was concerned that we had put on page 2 that the new application process would start July 1, 2010. They wanted more time to prepare, so we said, you know, we'll give you till 2011. So that part we changed, and then we went ahead and changed the date of the bill becomes effective to January 1st, 2010 instead of 09. There is a Committee of the Whole amendment here in a moment that changes some of that, but why don't we go ahead and approve the Standing Committee amendment, and then I'll explain the Committee of the Whole amendment.
Question being called on the Standing Committee amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Those opposed, no. Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to House Bill 149 has been adopted. I'm going to interrupt the proceedings a second and recognize Representative Childers.
Mr. Chairman, it isn't very often people come here from Hot Springs County, but it is my great pleasure to recognize my predecessor of the Travel, Recreation, Wildlife Committee, also the former chairman of the Appropriations Committee that went from a conservative to a liberal. And I can understand it once you get on TRW, but I want y'all to welcome Mike Baker.
Mr. Baker, would you care to say a few words to the body?
Thank you, and I will keep them few. I do understand new members, members that I recognize, members that I came in with. It affects me every time I come on this floor, every time. And I apologize for that, but you'll understand. There is life after legislating, though. I will tell you that, and it's good out there. It's okay out there. Mail reduces by 2/3, phone calls by 3/4, and enjoyment of life, well, it's mixed. Subjects, I continue to be asked, do you miss it? And my answers are depending on the issues. There are some that I already have my argument formed. They're ready, and I could strike you down if you were opposed to me, and I would be sure of it. And some, well, they have faded into obscurity, and I hope they stay there. Mr. Chairman, members of the body, it is a privilege to sit here, understand, and grow. You will, if given the opportunities, have unbelievable amounts of growth if you allow yourselves. Think. Obviously you are. We came in, a few of us, as the largest class to enter since 1913. It was a class of 92. We call ourselves the 52nd, the group of the 52nd. There are very few of us left here on this floor. 34 of us out of 60. As freshmen, none of us made committee chairman, but several made vice chair of committees. One, myself. Amazing changes. Term limits had just come in, and it had, and also reapportionment. It changed the House forever. Golly, my friends, understand and know that you will make friends here that will never, ever be lost. Never. I have friends across this state, and friends that I disagreed strongly with are just as strong as friends that I agreed with almost on every issue. They will become friends. They will stay friends. Learn, and you are. And grow, and you are. And think. And return home every day in your mind. Wyoming doesn't exist just within these four walls. You represent Wyoming. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for introducing me, and Mr. Chairman for giving me the opportunity to speak.
We're on House Bill 149, as amended by Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, Representative Gingrey. Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1. What this does, it deletes part of what we just did. We had changed the enactment date from July 109 to July 1, 2010. But then after we did that, then I had a conversation with LSO, and I didn't realize this, and you learn something every day, but whenever we postpone the enactment dates beyond the year we're in, what they end up having to do, and you've seen it a few times, especially with sales tax statutes, they have to print them twice in the statutes. If you ever flip through some of the sales tax parts, there'll be like a whole page in italics and then a whole page in regular print, one for the current year, one for the next year, and it just adds to their printing cost. So it was suggested that maybe for the enactment part, go back to July 109 and leave in place the 2011 for the application. That was the part the Secretary of State's office was concerned about. So I would, unless there's any questions about that, I'd ask for a favorable vote on the Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1.
Question being called. All those in favor of Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 149 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to House Bill 149 has been adopted. We're back on the bill. Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This only took me 2 days to explain in committee, so I'll try to keep it a little shorter. First of all, just to explain what a notary does. Our entire system of economics cannot survive without the notary. Imagine it this way. The only thing that says you actually own your house, the only reason why someone just can't show up at your front door and remove you from your home just because they're bigger than you, is because we have a system of law. And part of that system of law is that we record mortgages and we record deeds at the county clerk's office. And that people sign those deeds and they get them notarized, meaning, yes, that is my signature. That years later someone doesn't show up and say, I never signed that. I never sold my house to so-and-so. This is how our whole entire system works, is by ensuring that those truly are our signatures when we sign our name. This bill, along with the bill we did last year on notarial acts, is a means of helping our business environment and improving our business environment in comparison to other states in the union without ever actually even having to spend a dime, just by improving our laws so that companies see that Wyoming is on the cutting edge of a business environment. And that's what this bill can do. Last year we had a bill that did pass. It was called the Uniform Notarial Acts. That bill dealt with the actual act of a notary, the statements made that get put next to the signature line, dealing with foreign notarial acts and other states' notarial acts. And that bill we finished last year. This year it was brought to my attention that if I tackled that one, that we probably need to go in and tackle the notaries themselves. And here's the issue. We have not updated our notary acts since the early part of, well, not even this century, last century. What this bill is the Model Notary Act of 2002, promulgated by the National Notary Association. And to be honest with you, their bill, the Model Act is much bigger than this. And actually, when I first had it written up by LSO, it was a lot thicker. And then I sat down with the Secretary of State's office and sat down with notaries and sat down with the county clerks and with title companies. And there were certain parts of it people said, you know, those are good ideas, but that's a lot to deal with all in 1 year. Let's take this in pieces. Let's sort of do the pieces right now that are a little bit more non-controversial. And the parts that came out were, there's a big push throughout the union to have electronic notary. If you were to send me a document at my office, I do a lot of my signatures through PDFs, and I actually have a PDF signature, and then my documents get sent back to whoever sent them to me, they're not faxed, they're not mailed, they're just done by electronically, but it truly has my signature because I give my electronic signature. But I took all that out because that seemed a little confusing and people aren't quite ready for that. But we did go ahead and say, well, which parts of this could work? And so here's how this bill is sort of structured. Article 1 is the definitions. If you turn to the front of the bill, you won't actually see the definitions. They're actually in the back of the bill, because where I put them in is in the definitions that we created last year with the Uniform Notarial Act. Article 2 deals with if you're applying to be a notary. You know, what are the requirements to being a notary? Article 3 is, what are your powers of a notary? This was, Article 3 was one section that a lot of the notaries actually appreciated. A lot of times there's some iffiness as to, well, can I do this? Can I not do this? If the person's intoxicated, should I go ahead and sign it? If the person doesn't look like they quite understand what they're doing? And so there were some questions as to, when do I say yes and when do I say no? And so that's all laid out in that powers of notary, and luckily these great minds that, you know, came together across the country to make this model act, they came up with how to do that. Article 4 deals with the fees. We haven't changed any of the fees in the law, just made it more clear how we do it. It's always been this $2 thing, but for the most part, it's very rare that a notary will actually ask you for the $2. Article 5 deals with a journal, and I'll come back to that one in a second. Article 6 is, what does the signature post look like and what does your seal look like, just defining it. Article 7 is your change of status, meaning you change your residency, you got married, your name changed, how do you get a new stamp, those type of things. And Article 8 is your liability, the bond is $5,000. The areas that this thing really changes is, it clarifies better what the qualifications are. It outlines a procedure for the Secretary of State to deny an application. It moves the filing to the Secretary of State's office rather than the county clerk's. There's no requirement to be able to read and write in English, and we certainly could entertain an amendment if that's important to somebody. We had a long debate in that in committee, and we could certainly get into that discussion here. It clarifies when a notary should not notarize a document, and it creates the requirement to keep a journal. And if there's any part of this that's in any way controversial, potentially, I guess, the journal part would be. And just to explain what a journal does, and in most notaries that are doing a very good job will have a journal book. If you go into a bank, they always have the journal. If you go into a lawyer's office, they usually have the journal. But right now, we don't actually require the journal. And here's what a journal does. Imagine a book that you open up and there's maybe 40 lines on one page. When they notarize your document, they also write your name into their journal, give a brief descriptor of what that document was, will, contract, deed, and then they have you sign the journal too, and they put the date. The reason for doing that is that later on, if there's ever a controversy in court where someone comes in and says, I never signed that document, that's not my signature, you have to bring the notary in, and the notary has to say, yep, that's my notary stamp. Yeah, I notarized that document. They can, instead of having to say, yeah, I think that was winter time, it might have been spring I did that, I can't quite remember it, instead they can bring out their journal and go, yep, I know what date I did that on. I did it on January 29th. It was a contract I was doing that day, and here's his signature, and it matches the signature on the document. That's a journal, and that would be required, that they have the journal. Instead of me going through the entire bill, it's actually easier if I answer questions of people, and maybe that'll be quicker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a couple questions for the good chairman. First of all, this is a huge rewrite of something. Generally, this comes before a committee, and a committee takes the interim to talk to various folks and has meetings. This is a large rewrite of a piece of legislation. Also, after talking to the folks down on the first floor in the southwest corner, yes, they were consulted, but no, I don't think that they're from my understanding and from listening to them, this is such a big rewrite and a change without them really having had the opportunity to have gone through hearings and so forth. I think, quite frankly, they would rather see it postponed for another day.
Chairman Landon.
Mr. Chairman, I did notice on the
sheet that you had passed out, or that had been passed out, that there was no requirement to be able to read and write English. I was curious as to the conversation that decided that and where in the bill that is.
Representative Lubnow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And noting that my name is on the front page, probably I should have asked this question before. What happens if you don't keep a journal? What happens if the notary doesn't keep a journal, or the journal is lost?
Representative Zwanitzer, the elder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 10, it sort of indicates that the notary is supposed to know if a gentleman is intoxicated or if they're not sure what they're signing. And then if you go back on page 37, it basically holds, page 37 at the top, it basically holds the notary for all damages proximately caused that person by the notary officer's negligence. I was wondering if you could respond to that. It just seems to me that it puts the notary right in the middle of something. And I suppose the other question I have is, you know, at the moment, some notaries just use them in their businesses for just, say, one particular event. And I don't know, and now we don't have to keep a journal and et cetera, and don't have to charge. And I see you don't have to charge here, but I'm just wondering, what's the real purpose of this bill? Has there been a lot of problems in the state of Wyoming that I'm not aware of? Thank you.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for the bringer of the bill related to the journal keeping requirement. In some businesses, I'm thinking of the instance of an affidavit of publication. On a monthly basis, there may be mass notarizations that are required to be completed to go out with a monthly issuance of statements. Signing, for instance, the affidavit of publication that needs to be notarized, and what is each of those 130 affidavits of publication required to be entered separately in a journal? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll start at the bottom and work my way up. In the first question dealing with mass notarizations, the purpose of the journal is just so the person knows when they did it and that they can keep a record of it. Clearly, I think that issue, what you could do, since it's the same person who's going to be notarizing it, all 130 of them, you just need to put in one entry. Notarized 130 affidavits of publication, put the name of whoever did that, signed all of those, and put that in. I don't think you need to re-enter it every time because it's the same person. The intent was to remind you that you did it on that day, that you did 130. As to problems in the state, I actually didn't know much about notaries until a few years ago when we had a massive, a huge embezzlement case in my county in which the notary stamps were being used improperly. And the only way we ever figured it out was the young lady always used her middle initial when she signed her name, and none of these had her middle initial in them. And what had happened, her stamp had been stolen, and millions of dollars had actually been transferred using this stamp. This bill wouldn't actually stop that type of problem, but it got me very interested in how notaries work and got me talking to notaries across the state and learning about a lot of their different issues, which we fixed a lot of them last year. A lot of the issues that notaries had, we dealt with the bill last year. As to the negligence, that's essentially, it's the same negligence that's there today. They carry a bond. Your bond company pays it out up to that limit if you did something wrong, such as, I mean, here's an example. You're notarizing your own signature, even though in some improper way or something like that. As to what happens if you don't keep a journal, the Secretary of State would have the option then to bring you in and potentially remove your notarization commission. Whether or not they would do that or not, or whether or not they would just bring you in and ask you, why aren't you keeping a journal, and remind you to do that. As for the journal part, if that's a huge heartburn to a lot of people, I have no problem if that whole section is amended out of the bill. It was a part that the notaries were very adamant about. The notaries are trying very hard to raise the caliber of you know, the level of how they are perceived. And they felt the journal is an extremely important part to what they're doing, that there's a record of when they did it. What was the other one? Oh, reading and writing English. Again, if you wanted to do an amendment to put that in, that's fine by me. The concept there was that there are some situations in some communities that people that speak perhaps a different language are actually only notarizing those documents that are written in that language. And so if you're a Spanish speaker and you're notarizing Spanish documents, was there really a need for you to know English since you're not notarizing English documents? That was the one concern. I don't think it's that big of a concern. So if you wanted to stick that in, you have to be able to read and write English. That's a fine amendment. And as for the flip-flop downstairs, I'm just flabbergasted by that. We had testimony from in committee. I'm very confused by that. I wrote this bill back in April, mailed it to them. We worked throughout the summer, got feedback from them back and forth. And to hear now that this elected official has gone a different way completely frustrates me. Thank you.
Representative Zwanitzer the Younger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of questions, concerns. I also did talk to the Secretary of State on this bill, or at least several people in their office, and I wouldn't go as far to say that they are against the bill or they completely agree. It's one of these discussions we've had in this body for several years in all aspects of the Secretary of State's office on what is their function. Is it regulatory, or is it what they like to call smile and file? And with this bill, we're putting an additional, I would call it a burden, an additional responsibility on them. I think there is an administrative impact that they would have to hire another person, and they said it would cost $211,000 to their agency. I think I can quote that on the floor. It's their estimate of administrative impact, and basically says that they'd have to do some training and they would have to hire more staff, and they would have to do, I think what really scares them when I talk to them is the background checks. Background checks in the state aren't free. There is an administrative cost for someone to check with DCI and go through the process. So I also did ask them, I didn't hear it referred to on the floor, but they said they'd only had 6 reported problems in 14 years under the current law, and so they were just a little bit maybe uneasy that it didn't come through as a committee bill, or it wasn't brought on their behalf or by their wishes. So I wouldn't say they're necessarily in disagreement when I talked to them, but they did have some reservation where the bill came from, why it was coming, and what it does to their agency. But that's not unsimilar to a lot of other agencies with what we do here either. So I just wanted to make sure the good bringer in the body knew that there wasn't a full statement of intent against. It was just kind of, is it really necessary at this time, and what will it do to their agency? Thank you.
Chairman Semlich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe we got some insight as to what effect provisions of this bill might have for the Secretary of State. I guess my question is, in regard to our county clerk offices, what effect might that have with the workload in those offices, and if the clerks are aware of it, and if, in fact, they do support the provisions here?
Chairman Gingrey.
As to the county clerks, I did send this to the county clerks and work with them throughout the summer. What this bill does actually is takes us out of their offices, so they were fine with it leaving their office. But if we need to put it back in their offices, I certainly can work on that on second reading. I'm just amazed by our Secretary of State, and I'm very frustrated. We had testimony in our committee, and I wish they would just tell us what their real thoughts are on something. As to the role of the Secretary of State being regulatory versus smile and file, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think we have to have a long talk about where we're at. If that's what they want to do down there is just smile and file, you know, I guess we can do that for them and switch this back to the county clerks. The county clerks were willing to do it, and I'm disappointed.
Representative Lubnow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question that I had about the effect of the journal, and I understand maybe the possibility of amending it out, is would there be an effect on any of the instruments that were notarized by the non-existence of the journal, and would the sponsor be amenable to an amendment that said, in and of itself, the non-existence of a journal doesn't have any effect on the validity of an instrument so that we can rely upon those instruments if they're recorded? So you have to have something more than just the non-existence of the journal to attack the credibility of an instrument.
Chairman Gingrey.
Yes, that would be fine. The journal, as it's been explained to me by the Notary Association, was simply to help in the testimony of a notary, to remind them on the date they did something and to be able to compare signatures.
Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Gingrey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that House Bill 149, as amended, do pass, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
House Bill 149 has passed Committee of the Whole. Division being called. All those in favor, please stand. House Bill 149 has passed Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion carries.
Will the reading clerk please read the Committee of the Whole report?
Mr. Speaker, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, beg leave to report as follows. House Bill 182, recommended do pass. House Bill 110, amended, recommended do pass. Representative Buchanan moved that the Committee of the Whole rise and sit again, and the motion prevailed. House Bill 82, amended, recommended do pass. House Bill 221, recommended do pass. House Bill 13. Following a failed roll call vote, the bill is deemed indefinitely postponed. House Bill 16, amended and further amended. And further amended, recommended to do pass. House Bill 149, amended and further amended, recommended to do pass. Signed, Representative Brown, Chairman.
Mr. Speaker, I move adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The Committee of the Whole report is adopted. Thank you, Representative Brown. Messages from the Senate.
Message number 139. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 80. Electrical installation exceptions. Ayes 23, no 7. Signed, Diana Williams, and Senate Chief Clerk. Message 140, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate file number 112, archaic price regulation repeal. Ayes 30, no 0, signed Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 141, Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 5, State Parks and Cultural Resources, South Pass City. Ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 142. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 16, State Butterfly. Ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 143, Mr. Speaker. The bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 37, Antifreeze and Petroleum Products. Ayes 28, no 2. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 144. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 69, Fertilizers. Ayes 29, noes 1. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 145. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on a third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File number 105, Weed and Pest Control Districts, Unfair Competition. Ayes 30, no 0. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 146. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below failed to pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 11, State Parks Ranger Authority. Ayes 15, noes 15. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk.
It's nice to see that the Senate's hard at work. Butterflies and fertilizer. Mr. Reading Clerk, reports from standing committees.
Mr. Speaker, your Judiciary Committee number one, to whom was referred House Bill 72, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Begbie, Barbudo, Kennedy, Gingrey, Mercer, Patton, Peasley, Quarburg, Throne, signed representing Gingrey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom was referred House Bill 77, respectfully reports same back with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Barbudo, Kennedy, Gingrey, Patton, Throne. No, Begbie, Mercer, Peasley, Quarburg. Signed, representing Gingrey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number one, Judiciary, to whom was referred House Bill 241, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Begbie, Barbudo, Kennedy, Gingrey, Mercer, Patton, Peasley, Quarburg, Throne. Signed, representing Gingrey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number three, Revenue, to whom was referred House Bill 145, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Anderson, Edmonds, Escobel, Goggles, Madden, Miller, Peterson, Semlek, Wallace. Signed, Representative Anderson, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number three, to whom was referred House Bill 186, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Anderson, Edmonds, Goggles, Madden, Miller, Peterson, Semlek, Wallace. No, Escobel. Signed, Representative Anderson, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number four, Education, to whom was referred House Bill 114, respectfully reports back, same back the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Brechtel, Connolly, Kraft, Dirks, Yagi, Lubno, McKim, McComey, Teeters. Signed, Representative McComey, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number six, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, to whom is referred House Bill 133, respectfully reports same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Bonner, Brown, Childers, Connolly, Davison, Yagi, Millen, Shepperson, Thompson. Signed, Representative Childers, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number seven, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom is referred House Bill 74, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Brown, Kraft, Hales, Illaway, Lubnow, Miller, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dan, excused, Dirks, signed Representative Illaway, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred House Bill 78, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Brown, Kraft, Hales, Illaway, Lubnow, Miller, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dan, excused, Dirks, signed Representative Illaway, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred House Bill 104, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Brown, Kraft, Lubnow, Miller, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dan. No, Hales, Illaway. Excused, Dirks. Signed, Representative Illaway, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom was referred House Joint Resolution 9, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Brown, Kraft, Illaway, Lubnow, Miller. No, Hales, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dan. Excused, Dirks, signed Representative Illaway, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 44, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Brechtel, Byrd, Harvey, Lockhart, Meyer, Moniz, Roscoe, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dave, signed Representative Lockhart, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred House Bill 156, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Brechtel, Byrd, Harvey, Lockhart, Meyer, Moniz, Roscoe, Stubson, Zwanitzer, Dave, signed Representative Lockhart, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred House Bill 31, respectfully report same back to the House with recommendation that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Bonner, Escobel, Goggles, Hallinan, Harvey. No, Davison, Landon, Millen, Shepperson. Signed, Representative Landon, Chairman.
Chairman Illaway, committee announcements.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, will meet Tuesday upon noon recess in House 18. We're going to take up House Bill 38, Fiscal Year for Governmental Entities, House Bill 39, Population Determinations, Use of Federal Census, House Bill 168, Motor Vehicle Financial Responsibility, House Bill 187, Early Detection Smoke Alarms, and if there's time, House Bill 188, Insurance Coverage of Phenylketonuria.
Chairman Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 1, Judiciary, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. to hear House Bill 243, District Attorney's Salary, House Bill 115, DUI Penalties, House Bill 251, Trust Retirement Funds Accounting.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. 2 announcements. Mr. Speaker, I'd like to re-refer House Bill 114 to Appropriations, Committee Number 2, Appropriations. It has an appropriation in it.
Hearing no objection, it's so ordered.
And, Mr. Speaker, the House Education Committee will meet upon adjournment tonight in room H10, where we'll take up athletic trainers licensing, physician school assistant school, and Hathaway Scholarship Program eligibility requirements.
Chairman Semlich.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Lands, and Water Resources, will meet tomorrow morning, Tuesday, January 27th at 7 a.m. We'll continue work on House Bill 14, Discharge Water Management, House Bill 97, Weights and Measures, House Bill 100, Omnibus Water Bill Planning, and House Bill 213, Rangeland Monitoring. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Thank you. Chairman Cohey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 8 on Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs will meet tomorrow night, January 27th, 15 minutes after adjournment, in room H-17 to discuss the following bills: House Bill 183, Military Tuition Assistance; House Bill 162, State Employees Retirement Military Credit; House Bill 192, Military Scholarships; House Bill 96, Railroad Quiet Zones; and House Bill 233, Trains Blocking Roadways.
Chairman Landon.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet 10 minutes after adjournment this afternoon to hear House Bill 157, Child Fatality Review, and House Bill 146, Emergency Medical Services Sustainability Trust.
Thank you. House Committee Chairman, there will be a brief meeting in room 302 upon adjournment. Representative Patton.
Mr. Speaker, Representative Blake joins me in asking for a ruling from the chair, and I hope that it won't take 30 minutes to do this, but I have an unsigned package that has a unwarranted gift, I gather, and I do not want to flaunt the Constitution that says that we should not accept anything of value.
I don't think
the determination of the chair would either mean that you can determine this to be of little or no value, whereupon I will have to take it home.
The ruling of the chair is that it looks very nice in your hand and will look even nicer around your neck tomorrow as you wear it on the floor as a penalty for bringing it to our attention. And Representative Blake, the same goes for you. And thank you very much. That is the ruling from the chair. Thank you. Any other announcements? Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I move that we adjourn until 10 a.m. Tuesday, January 27, 2009.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. We are adjourned until tomorrow morning at 10 a.m.